Welcome back to the Leadership Domain, where we believe that who is greater than why. I'm your host, John Rohn, and we're here to share stories told by leaders themselves. Each episode is a glimpse into their who, and serves to connect them with you, our listeners. We hope that their lessons, thoughts, and vulnerabilities also serve to unlock your full leadership potential. We're glad you're here with us. Lead them well. Our guest today is Major General Deanna Burt. She is a leader in the United States Space Force. We discuss how passion can be contagious, her views on gender bias with respect to women in command, how to reward bold strategy and bold leadership, and how sometimes the, quote, moat dragons, end quote, can prevent connection and trust. I hope you enjoy it. I had a blast. Lead them well. Welcome back to the Leadership Domain podcast. I hope everybody is doing well. Today is March the 3rd, and I'm excited not only because it's Women's History Month and we've got a female leader, but I'm excited because this is somebody that I've looked up to for nearly 20 years now. Major General Deanna Burt, call sign Spice, is currently the commander of the Combined Force Space Component Command, a U.S. Space Command, and the deputy commander of Space Operations Command at the U.S. Space Force, which is at Vandenberg. In those jobs, she plans and executes space operations across the globe and for almost 17,000 joint combined personnel. General Burt graduated with distinction from the ROTC program at Embry-Riddle and is also a graduate and former instructor at the United States Air Force Weapons School, which is the first place that I met her back in 2000. So, ma'am, thank you for the time. As I've always said, you can go to Air Force or the Space Force page and get your bio that I just read to people. But what is something that's not in the bio that either makes you or is important to who you are today?
Oh, thanks, Big Dog. It's great to be on this podcast, and thanks for honoring me and letting me be a part of it. I think what makes me, if I had to define, would be that I came in on active duty in October of 1992, so just post Desert Storm, which was our first what we would call space war, if you will, or where space had combat effects that were applied downrange to defeat the enemy. And so my whole career has been spent looking at space from a warfighting perspective, how to do integration, again, going to weapons school and SAS. All of my experiences have been, how do we take those space effects and best deploy them in a joint multi-domain fight? And now to see it evolve even to a combatant command and a service, because the domain is now contested, because the enemy recognizes that space is critical to our American way of life and our American way of war. So they're looking to take that from us. So now to even step to the next level of how do we work in this warfighting domain. So all of my experience has really, from the beginning and post-Desert Storm in 92 to where we are today, have been prepping me for this. And I've been blessed to get developed over the years to really focus on that, because I think senior leaders that were in front of me saw this coming. And knew that we had to start getting after that warfighting mentality and working closely with the Air Force and now the Space Force to continue to develop that.
I have to ask, you know, when former President Trump first mentioned the Space Force, I think people thought, well, this is something that he's going to talk about. Administration has the right to do that. But it happened relatively quickly. Did that surprise you or the rest of the space community?
I think it happened relatively quickly, Big Dog, but I want to make sure folks track that we had a U.S. Space Command up until 2001. And due to 9/11 and the attacks on our nation, we chose to stand down that COCOM and stand up NORAD-NORTHCOM. And so U.S. Space Command then became a joint functional component under U.S. STRATCOM. So again, we thought space was important in the Cold War days as we were working against the former USSR. So that's always been there. We stood it down due to other threats of our nation, but it's almost like immediately from standing it down, we started trying to stand it back up because we had the Space Commission that was run by Rumsfeld. I mean, we've had various things that have been bleeding back to this conversation. I also think the threat gets a vote. The enemy gets a vote, and Russia and China are actively launching capabilities into orbit or things that from direct ascent ASATs and have been testing them. Over the last 5 to 6 years, I mean, I want you to think about in 2007, Major Burt was sitting at Vandenberg when the Chinese shot down their own dead satellite. At that time, we couldn't talk about it. We didn't talk about it until 2015 with General Hyten, the first time we talked about a war that could extend into space. So again, this isn't new. It's been a conversation. Some of it has been hamstrung by classification and how we can talk about and attribute and share with the American people. But I think it is now accelerated to the point that we recognize, as did Congress. I mean, so I know a lot of people, former President Trump was absolutely instrumental in starting the dialogue, but understand that Congress was also very much engaged with this. And this was a bipartisan answer to stand up a US COCOM, US Space Command, as well as a service. So again, yes, what happened really fast from our perspective as the guys planning it. And when I first got to Air Force Space Command, we were standing up US Space Command, and we stood it up in August of 19. Yes, the Space Force was in dialogue as well, because that was when the presidential announcement came out in February of 2019 about standing up a space service, a space force. But to think it would happen a mere 4 months after standing up Space Command, that was tough. Because again, the same operators who were in space professionals who were standing up Space Command then had to shift and then also now stand up a service. So it's been a lift, but it's been super exciting. I mean, in my 28-year career, I mean, this is just absolutely incredible, the amount of work and excitement and moving forward to make change. And it's pretty amazing. I mean, in 70-plus years, we haven't had a new service. So it's pretty cool to see. And I'm hoping, again, that as the Space Force stands up, there's lots that can be gained in the greater department of the Air Force and for the Air Force and the other services as we learn things and we move quickly as a small service.
Reference moving quickly as a small service and being new and having a spotlight on you as one of the senior leaders. There's a spotlight because you're a major general. There's probably also a spotlight, or there is a spotlight on you because you're a female major general. I mentioned earlier, this is March and Women's History Month. Do you feel in your position the weight of that spotlight? And if so, in what ways do you share those lessons with others?
Absolutely. I think over the course of my career, I did a Women's History Month opening yesterday. And one of the things that I highlighted was when I came in to ROTC and when I actually raised my hand, because I was a scholarship student, so I had to sign in 1987. The service was much smaller in percentage, on the order of 6% women. And now today we're at about 12% in the Space Force. There was one female general in the Air Force when I came in 1987. Today, the General Officer Corps, we make up about 16% of the General Officer Corps for women. So again, the numbers are getting better, but again, we want the military to be a reflection of the country that we serve and the demographics of the country that we serve. So again, women are about 50-ish percent of our population. So how do we continue to improve and recruit women and get them and retain them and keep them in the military to rise to the ranks that I am? I've been blessed to have amazing mentors. Again, I didn't work for very many female bosses, but I had amazing male bosses who saw my potential and mentored me along the way. I do feel pressure to make sure that I'm paying it forward to those who are behind me and sharing stories and letting them know things are better and we are moving in the right direction. There's been a lot of change in the Air Force and in the Space Force in the last year. I mean, think about all the hair standards that just changed here in the last few weeks, the uniform items that are going to come out the middle of March, and those are good for men and women, right? A lot of things that have been entrenched that we refuse to address are now being addressed, and it's pretty exciting to see. But I think what's important as we move into the information age is that we can't make decisions as leadership teams if we all look and think alike. There has to be diversity of background, diversity of where you grew up in the country, diversity of ethnicity, gender. All those diverse capabilities come together in a team and make us stronger because we get better innovative ideas and solutions than what we have done in the past in the industrial age. And I think as you move forward in the digital age, flattening the organization and empowering the lowest level and getting that diversity is really where the Space Force is trying to go in order to move faster. And again, it's really hard when you've been living in the industrial complex and you have that pyramid and you're building out all that bureaucracy. That's how you grew up. So if you want to talk about biases, you're sort of biased to the hierarchy, right? And when I say, nope, let's flatten it, everybody goes, wait, you moved my cheese. And that's a little hard. That's a little hard for senior leaders. So it's, again, old dogs and new tricks. We need to adjust to where the vision is going. And so I think we're doing that in the Space Force, and we're being led by our CSO who gets it, General Raymond. And I think we're on board and we're moving fast. And in reality, the beauty of being small is we don't have a choice but to be innovative, because we don't have the resources from a human capital perspective to throw at it, because the numbers, I mean, we're only going to be 16,000 strong. That's not very big. And so we're going to have to embrace technology. We have to get after artificial intelligence. We have to free the human capital up to do the things that only humans can do. So I think just our natural size is forcing us as senior leaders to get out of our comfort zone and know that, embrace it, because we don't have a choice.
You talked about retention, and I contend that recruiting, whether it's minorities or women, is not really the challenge. It's the retention that's the challenge. And often when you mention diversity, I think we also don't go one step further, which is making those diverse individuals feel like they belong and are connected to that service. You've obviously had challenges throughout your career. You said 28 years now. Can you think of one, whether it has to do with you being a woman or just a leader in general, that has impacted you and specifically the way you lead and lead others?
I think it's important when over time, I think people have to, we tend to, so I want to give you an example of tangible that just happened this morning. I have an amazing young African-American female tech sergeant, and she made tech sergeant Monday. And she was like, look, hey, I don't want a big deal. I don't want a, you know, big thing and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, nope, we're doing something. And right. She looked at me like, you're going to make me have a party. And I go, yeah, because there are young African-American female airmen who look up to you, and we should celebrate you. We should celebrate you like I celebrate every airman or guardian. Everyone needs to be celebrated. Now, for her, she was out of her comfort zone. She didn't like being recognized. So again, when we talk about biases, I think there's biases on both sides. There's, hey, I'm a woman, I'm African-American, I am a person of color. I've been taught to put my head down, do good work, and not highlight myself. I've had airmen and guardians tell me that. And I go, okay, we have to change that. Because we're a meritocracy, and I'm looking for innovation, and I'm looking for you to take risk, and I need you to step out. So here, I'm going to help you, and I'm going to mentor you, and we're going to put you in this position, and you're going to get a chance to show your stuff. But I need you to step up, and it's going to feel weird, but I'm right here with you. That's mentoring, and that has to happen. But we've got to teach them that they need to come out and show themselves and be vocal and step up. At the same time, I would tell you as a senior leader, I know for a fact I have biases. I tell this story often, and part of it as leaders is knowing it's unconscious. You know, it's not like you do it out of malice or being bad. It's a fact. So I always go in, if I were to meet you, big dog, I would immediately go, and I never met you before, I would go, so do you have a wife or a girlfriend?
Right.
And I immediately assume a heterosexual couple, not because I have anything against the LGBTQ community, but just how I was raised in the South. And I asked that question. I've gotten burned on that a couple of times where the person looks at me and they're all uncomfortable, and they'll be like, well, you would respond to me, well, ma'am, my boyfriend. And then I'm like, stupid, stupid, stupid. And I'm hitting myself in the face, and I go, I am so sorry. You're right. And then I go right back to the question. So how long have you been dating your boyfriend? Because again, it wasn't about that I have a problem with someone being a gay or a lesbian. It's just a bias that I have. So now I really have to think about when I meet someone for the first time, to use the word spouse and significant other. That's my problem, not their problem. That's me. And I think as leaders, to get past biases because they're unconscious, we're really going to have to dig deep. And when we screw it up, being willing to say, oh, my bad, I'm sorry. That's not you, that's me. And I've gained more street cred by doing that than being awkward and not addressing that I screwed it up, right? That's part of leadership, is being able to admit when you do something wrong, or you think of something and you don't do it the right way. How do you accept accountability and say you screwed it up? I think the more of that we can do, the better. And lastly, I would also say relationships are critical. I grew up as the only woman many times in many classes, whether it be weapons school, SAS, I quit counting. But what I would tell you is I found peers and mentors in class with me that became the folks that I leaned on and got through, just like all my other classmates had friends that they leaned on and we're support networks. And so I think that's important as well. It's getting to know each other and know each other's stories and not making assumptions based on what someone looks like, the color of their skin or their gender, but getting to know them at the human to human level. And I think we will find we have more in common than we have different if we're willing to be brave and vulnerable enough to share our stories. So when you ask me, you know, what I find a weight on my shoulders is to share these kinds of stories that probably, frankly, I'm not perfect, never have been, never will be, but you're willing to show as a senior leader that, hey, I screw it up sometimes too, and I'm not perfect, and that's okay. I think making yourself vulnerable as a senior leader is critical to do that, because then you're a human, you're not perfect, and they know that they can then be you because you're not perfect. But we've got to see faces at the senior level that people can look up to and see themselves. But if I can't look up and see myself because you're not human to me or you're not a person to me, then we've failed as well as senior leaders to connect with our airmen and our guardians.
So many things to unpack in that. So thank you, ma'am. You mentioned gender bias, and I know that you know, in last month, General Brown, General Raymond directed the services or the Air Force and the Space Force to go one step further beyond the racial disparity discussion that was our report that was released, and do the same study on racial, gender, and ethnic biases. So from a perspective of a woman, we all have friends that were both male and females who commanded. I could argue in some cases, I could sit in the office with the male and the female and they could give the exact same guidance. They can give the exact same discipline. They could say the exact same words. And somehow the individual that listened to the same words come out of a female may react negatively versus with if he or she heard that from the male. So from your perspective, is there in fact a gender bias at the command level? And then if so, how do you acknowledge and overcome that in the Space Force in particular?
I think there definitely is. And again, this goes back to the roles that you grew up with men and women in your life, right? So did you grow up in a household where your mom worked or didn't? Did you grow up in a house, again, where both parents were working? You know, in some cases you had a dad who was stay at home versus a mom. It just your gender roles and what you did growing up. So again, for me, I grew up in the South, but my dad was very hard over about, he wanted me to be able to take care of myself. And so growing up, like I wasn't allowed to drive a car until I could prove I could change the oil and the tires. And that was hard, but I learned. I cut grass with my brother. There were no gender-based chores. Like my brother did all the grass cutting and the trash and the stuff, and I did all the dishes and the cooking. No, we shared tasks and alternated who did what tasks, and we worked the tasks together, my younger brother and I. So I think I was raised to not ever think that I couldn't do something and that I could learn and figure it out. And so I've come into this that way from, and that's why I think the military, my dad was very rule-based. So I think I thrive in the military because I grew up in a very disciplined household and I was able to take care of myself and I could take instruction and it's proven okay for me so far. But where I would say it fell apart sometimes is how women and men respond to crisis is very different. And when I found this out the first time is at weapon school. I was the only student in my class and I was in a group of guys, and how I dealt with the stress of weapon school was very different. I noticed I got very much more emotional. I got tired. I got run down. And for me, the release was I would just have to go somewhere in a room and let it out. And that means I was crying. And I never wanted to do that in front of my classmates, but that I would do that and I would feel 100% better because I let it go. I have since found, now that I'm a more senior person, working out is key, because if I get stressed or get tired, I still push myself to go for a run or do something in a fitness perspective and I feel 10 times better. It's that physical release. I think guys handle stress a little differently. You're much more physical. You will tend to do those physical fitness things or punch things, or you emanate that stress in a different way. And I don't mean that punching in a bad way. You're much more physicality focused, but you're able to keep the presence. Again, I've seen guys break down too at weapon school, both as a student and an instructor. I'm not saying it's just women that do that. It's a tough place. But I noticed for me, that was the thing. And so how do I deal with it? The other piece is I'm very, very passionate. And I have to find ways when I am making an argument to make sure that I am not making the argument from my heart, but I'm making the argument from a position of facts. Because as soon as my voice elevates or I get excited about something, it's seen that I'm being emotional and not presenting from a senior leader perspective. And so I really cage myself that when I'm going into something that I really care about and is important, and I want to put a position on the table to try to do that from a facts-based position and have my homework done. Again, I think males should do that too. But I think for me, knowing my passion, it's been something that I've become self-aware of and learned, And so what I think is also important as leaders, as we look to the people that we admire or want to emulate, what are the good and bad things we take with them? And then as leaders, how do we evolve with the times and what our guardians and airmen need from us as leaders? And that's different than when you and I came in the early 90s. I mean, it's not at all the same today. The generation is different. And so as a leader, when you stop learning, one of my key tenets is when I stop learning, I stop leading. And you're always evolving as a leader. You're not stagnant, and you have some core things that are really good about you that make you successful, but you're always evolving and polishing those skills to meet the problem and the challenges of the day. So I have seen women who, can evolve. I've seen male leaders who can evolve. And when they don't evolve, they are now being seen as toxic and they're being fired and they're not staying in the business. So I think it can be on both sides, but I have seen where, I've been considered tougher. How I've also tried to deal with that too is explaining, being more transparent as a leader on why I'm doing something. You know, making a decision and going, and here's the calculus that went into this decision and here's why. When I'm giving discipline to an individual, I'm giving them paperwork. I give them the paperwork, we go through the process, we sign all the paper, the JAG goes away. And then I say, okay, now we're at a different point. You have a choice. If you're kicking, I'm reaching. And we put this behind us. If you don't want to put this behind us, we can keep adding to the paper. And I'm here for you. And then I'd follow that again, not just with words, but with action. And then I would come find that individual and make a point. Hey, how are you, Airman so-and-so, Lieutenant so-and-so, and have a conversation. And they're not walking around with a scarlet letter. And I'm trying to give them opportunities to recover. That's critical as well. But I think they know I'm holding them accountable and why. But then I also then turn around and show them that I care about them. And if they're willing to recover, I'm willing to help them recover. And so I'm sure there's no one who's worked for me that wouldn't tell you that I'm a tough boss. But I hope, at least my hope is, as a legacy that I leave behind, is that the people that work for me know that I care about them. And that once they've worked for me and performed for me, I'm going to do my level best to help mentor and take care of them. And to move them forward and give them the skills that they need to be successful as well.
And I can attest to that personally. I can't remember how many years it was when we saw each other from, Nellis to the time I go back to Nellis as a group commander, and you're the one star. And I always felt that if I had an issue, I knew where to go. And you talked about your being self-aware about how you can come off when you're being passionate or that you needed to step away and be emotional. One of the things that I get to talk about when we're on the road is the difference between leader development and leadership development. Leader development being that human capital, and a big part of that is being self-aware. And then leadership development is the connection that a self-aware leader makes with his or her airmen or guardians or whatever the case is. In your transition from the Air Force to the Space Force and being a senior leader in the Space Force, do you have an assessment of what was missing, either your leader development or the leader development of airmen, and how you want to see that change or what you want to see different in the Space Force?
I think as we move forward in the Space Force, General Raymond has been very clear. I mean, we need this to be a digital service. We need this to be innovative, and we need folks that think of problems in an information age environment. And so it's going to have to be a flat organization, and we're going to have to empower the lowest levels. In order to do that, you're going to have to value leadership and develop leadership that values that, right? And you're going to have to get weak leaders to be self-aware when they are stifling that, right? For this to be successful, because we're used to an industrial-based model that's a pyramid that, I have a chain of command and I have things I have to do. Well, if I take levels of that pyramid out, so for the Space Force, we have flattened the organization. You go from the field command, which is a MAGCOM equivalent, to the deltas, which is a wing equivalent, all the way to the squadron. There is no group, there is no NAF. And so you guys have been trying this out on the Air Force side at Mountain Home. General Holmes is actually the one that talked to General Raymond about this extensively. And we executed it across the Space Force. And it is proven to be very valuable. And the wing Delta commanders are extremely, Delta and Garrison commanders are extremely empowered. They're leading their missions. But then the key problem or concern is, for a challenge for senior leaders, is that we don't stifle them in some way. So when they lean out and if they fail, okay, help, let me help you pick you up. Okay, that didn't work, so let's try again. We have to be willing to fall forward and to accelerate and be okay with that, because that's what innovation is about. Everything is not gonna work perfectly. How do we get to 80% is good enough, and let's keep moving and iterating on it? That whole DevSecOps development of software and capabilities, that's a different mindset than the way we've done programs of record in space and frankly, everywhere in the Department of Defense. How do we get after that mindset? So we have to leader develop that way. I would say right now, what's hard about being a general officer as we stand up to service is me fully recognizing I'm not going to be the digital warrior. It isn't it. I can talk about warfighting, and when they present cool ideas to me, I ask key questions about how can we bring it online and how can I knock down barriers for them. But I don't try to stifle the idea development and what they're coming up with. I see myself as a barricade runner, and all I'm doing is running through walls so that the capabilities they need to bring can come. But it's definitely a different mindset, and it's trusting your troops and having a relationship with your troops that they can talk to you and come to you for that advice and say, hey, ma'am, I think I'm doing this or that. What do you think? And giving them that feedback without shutting them down or telling them how to do it, right? Because I don't know how to do it anymore. It's a whole new world that I'm not as steeped in as they are. So I think that's leader development wise in the Space Force, what we're gonna have to do. And I got some of that in the Air Force, and I absolutely was told to run a lot in the Air Force and was given a lot of leeway to lead projects and do things. But I sense it even more that it's needed in the Space Force to get where we wanna be and very quickly. In order to match our near peer competitors who are at the door.
One of the challenges that I see when I get to go talk with airmen is the word innovation. We're told, yes, we want you to innovate. Yes, we want you to fail fast. But then in the 1 year performance report cycle, what you get graded on is how well you accomplished task X or Y and the impact that task had. Have you thought through, or how is a Space Force going to tackle rewarding innovation that fails? You tried it, it didn't work. It may not translate into a stratification on your evaluation, but I need you to know and everybody else to know that we are proud and we should continue to reward you for trying to innovate.
I think it has to translate into a stratification on your performance report. And in our human capital strategy, we're talking about that. How do we reward bold leadership? How do we document that on paper, not just talk about it? So that is in our human capital strategy right now that S1 is working to completion, is how are we going to change our performance reports, both officer and enlisted, to reflect that? And how do we, you know, measure and take account of when you tried new things and what new things did you bring online and how did you help? I mean, we've been doing some of that in OPR bullet writing and EPR bullet writing, right? Hey, brought on this new thing and saved this many dollars, or we hit this many more targets as a result of this TTP or whatever. We've been doing some of that in the Air Force, but I think in the Space Force, it's gonna be even more critical as we stand up these organizations and units pushing that system. The other piece that I think we gotta break down too is the acquisition side of the house, and that we talk about supracoders. So we have been sending folks to coding classes such that on the weapon system in real time, so you know, think about your background, ABM, I could be on the AWACS and I could be rewriting code on the AWACS that would help me do my job better. Wow. That's wow. Like mind blowing, right? Everybody's like, wait, that's a program of record. And how many airplanes are there? And oh my God, if you do that, you've now changed the baseline of the program.
Did you ask Boeing?
Yes. Did you ask Boeing? So how do we create that mindset? And how do we create that partnership with industry that we're building systems that allow us to do that? But at the same time, if I innovate in one squadron and find a way to do something, how do we make that an app or a thing that can then be applied to another squadron as they need it? But I don't need everybody to look exactly the same. There may be different tools that are used by different units to get the job done. Where it is important that we're standardized, or there are things that everyone can use, then how do you scale it up and put it across the service? And I think that's usually the hard part, right? What I've seen in the think tanks and the things the chief and secretary put forward in the Air Force and now in the Space Force, those there are amazing ideas that come up that you're just like, wow. Like, I think one year I was at AFA and it was saving the casings when you go to the range to shoot guns,
right,
and how they were going to repurpose those and how much money they were going to save. And I was like, wow, we haven't thought of that. That was impressive. And there are so many things, or the where you lay down in the tanker to refuel that year was the one that won, the pad that they remade on their own. But again, it's the upscale that was where it falls down. We have these great innovations and it's upscaling them to the larger organization. That's where it gets hard to do. I'm hoping that we are all hoping with the Space Force, because it is so small, we will be able to upscale faster and it won't be as difficult. And because we're trying to be software based rather than hardware based, that will make that, you know, fleet up easier to do, because again, it would be software apps or new code or new things that will enable the mission. And it doesn't require all new hardware to do that we would have to fleet across the service. So that's where I think we're trying to go. But I can understand folks being frustrated. They come up with great ideas, they do things. And then if they're not fleeted up or accepted, it can be frustrating. But again, we've got to break through that as both across the Department of the Air Force of how do we do that more efficiently? Because I do think there's some great opportunity out there that some great airmen and guardians are coming up with that we have to upscale.
Earlier in our discussion, you talked about being vulnerable. And I think that one of the contradictions, the ironies of leadership is that what airmen or guardians or any follower wants to see or loves to see are leaders who are vulnerable. But when we get into leadership positions, the one thing we don't want to do is be vulnerable. And I think a lot of times that leads to being a barrier to trust. So I'm out on the road, ask a question all the time. Hey, who in here trusts your leaders, whether it's senior leaders or immediate supervisors? And it's heartbreaking the number of times that very few hands go up. From your position and your perspective and your experiences, what is the biggest barrier to developing that leadership trust that you've seen?
I think it's having an ability to be approachable and have a conversation. I think I try really hard and I love my front office staff. But sometimes the moat dragons can keep you from knowing what's happening in your organization. And so you really have to get out and about and you have to make yourself available. And you have to make yourself available in a way that is not threatening. So for example, if I go out to a unit or one of my units with 5-6 people in tow, I have now an armada around me that's not letting airmen or guardian so-and-so come up directly to me and talk. So I try to go with the least amount of footprint as I can when I get out to visit folks so that I can get down and interact without someone being in between pretending to be a translator or a buffer, or they're only letting me see certain people, right? Here's the great airman. And that's important too, right? I want you to, as a commander, to show me who your best and brightest are. Absolutely. So when I see their names come up for stratification, I know I can point out, hey, I know who Big Dog is. I met him. But what about all the other folks who may or may not be happy? I need to see those folks too. So it's out, getting out and about. I absolutely believe you vote with your feet and you try to get around. I struggle every time to do that, but I work hard to get out and about. When you're TDY, you know, again, going with the least amount of footprint so that folks can approach you. I'm on Facebook. And so I will chime in when on social media, when folks have things. I'm careful doing that. But I do try to make myself accessible. I most people will tell you I post a lot of gym stuff because I want them to see I struggle to make sure I stay fit and resilient, just like I'm asking them to do. And it's not easy. And there are days I don't want to go to the gym and it's a struggle, but I get it done. So I think people seeing that you're a human and normal and vulnerable gives them hope that they can be you. The leader that General Raymond is probably one of the bosses that I've worked for over the past, and General Hyten as well, who would absolutely sit down and hey, Deanna, what you're feeling, I'm feeling too. Or, hey, yeah, that was a tough engagement. I remember the first time I did an interview and they would give me feedback because I was doing a lot of interviews as the 50th Space Wing Commander. Them sharing their lessons learned, or when you call and ask them for feedback that they give it to you, those are important. The other piece I would say that with the digital age that we can't let go of is what I call analog leadership. So I have a solid rule that if I sign a PRF for you of any performance recommendation form, that I am personally handing it back to you, or if you are TDY or deployed, that we are having a conversation on the phone, and as soon as that you're back and I can see you eyeball to eyeball, I'm giving you that form. And I will tell you you're number 1 of 48, and I will tell you you're number 48 of 48. Now, I didn't put number 48 of 48 on your form, but I let you know exactly where you are. Those are hard conversations. Those aren't fun for me to have, but I think they're critical to the individual to know I care enough to have a conversation. The other piece is when people get passed over. They're like, oh, ma'am, I got passed over. I don't need to come see you to get my PRF. I go, no, you're coming to see me. You don't get a choice. And then they're shocked when they come in here, like, why do you want to talk to me, ma'am? I got passed over. I'm like, that's okay. So what do you want to do next? How can I help you with what you want to do next? What do you want to do in the next life? Can I put you somewhere now? So you're passed over. You're not getting promoted. Got it. But is there some skill or some experience that you want to add to your resume that I could put you somewhere else and get you that? I'm not saying you're going to get promoted and that's not going to change, but is there something I can do to assist you on the other side and help you make this transition? Because you're valued to me. You've done a good job for me. I'm sorry you didn't get promoted, but that doesn't mean I don't care about you anymore just because you didn't get promoted. And I think that's the human element that sometimes due to crazy schedules at the GO level get dropped by the wayside, right? They get pushed off and we just email them out and we say, hey, my favorite line, if you want to come talk to me, here, Deanna, here's your PRF. If you want to come talk to me, let me know. The word if, I don't ever say, I'm go, here's your PRF. You will schedule with Lieutenant Colonel, whoever my exec is, to come see me. I don't give them a choice. Because if you give someone a choice, they're going to go, oh, General Burt's really busy. She didn't have time. You know, I'm good. Or the people who get the number one DP, they're like, why do I need to talk to her? I got a crushing PRF. Well, no, I need to talk to those people too. I need to go, you're doing great work. Now I want to talk about how we're going to get you to the next rank after that. And here's the things you need to be thinking about. So even the guys who are really crushing it need to be stroked and talked to and reinforced with the behavior. And then the people that are struggling, letting them know that and why. And then there's the people in the middle. Can I make a difference from one PRF to the next or one board to the next to go up and make the change? Where is that able to be done? As the DT chair within the 13th Sierra Career Field and Air Force Space Command, one of the things we looked at was at the 5-year time in service for our young captains. So think they got a training report from when they got their school and a couple OPRs. We racked and stacked those records. Now it was quick because some of them had crushing records. Some of them had not a single strat or any kind of delineation of an award or anything in the records. It just depended. But at that point, they are still moldable, right? If I came back to you and said, Big Dog, you're in the bottom third. You don't have a single strat or anything in your record. What are you doing? Are you making yourself available? Are you putting yourself out there? Are you being vulnerable? Have you taken on a lead of a project? You know, when your group or wing commander says, hey, I have a project, you should be going, hey, pick me. Are you doing those things? Because you need to delineate yourself from your peers and you don't appear to be doing anything outside of the norm. How do you accelerate your game? Having those conversations early when they're fixable. I almost cry when I'm at the majors board and particularly Lieutenant Colonel board writing PRFs, because at that point your record's your record. It's really hard to make major swings at that point. So we have to start mentoring and talking to people earlier in that development and making ourselves vulnerable with those folks earlier to be able to give them advice of what they should be getting after. And I think those PRF discussions or when I can give you an exact how you did on something back, I'm able to share my experience with you and be vulnerable. And then you're also able to ask me questions and have those things. And I think, again, that touch maintenance 1v1 is critical moving forward.
Hard conversations are, it's a systemic problem. You know, I think some of the times the reason people don't come and talk to General Burt or General anybody or Colonel anybody is because we're groomed not to. You're groomed to not go have those hard conversations because you're passed over. Don't waste the boss's time. But I think that also extends into some of the harder conversations that we're not having today. Race, gender, we've covered it earlier. And I think part of the problem is not the fact that people have blind spots or unconscious biases, because that's factual. You're always going to. Part of the problem, I believe, is as leaders, we're not groomed or taught how to have those hard conversations. Therefore, we don't teach our majors and airmen to have hard conversations without getting offended that somebody, you know, the ones you don't talk about are the party, right? Politics, religion, sexual orientation. As soon as somebody brings those up, somebody's always on the defensive. I've learned now, I think, through marriage and being raised, that you're not going to change people's opinion on a lot of those things. So I think my point too is, how do we teach people to have those hard conversations when nobody is comfortable doing that right now? And I'm not just talking the PRF or the race or the hard conversations in general.
So what's really interesting, I think it's funny because I think it's generational, right? So a story, I was a wing commander and we were talking about, this is right when same-sex marriage was approved and you could still be in the military, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed, and we were all into that, right? Everyone that was, you know, colonel and above and the chief, we were all very uncomfortable, like, okay, what are we going to do with this? And how do we talk about this? And what do we, and everybody was unusual. Whereas my young airmen and guardians were like, what's the big deal? We've grown up with the LGBTQ community all the time. I don't understand why you guys are weird.
Right.
So it is generational to some degree. And I would say as leaders right now, the generation we are leading want to talk. They have no filters. They right. want to talk. They want to put their ideas out there. They're passionate and they are extremely smart and innovative. We have to be willing to listen and get past you. This is how I was raised not to talk. No, we need to be talking. So this gets back to that evolving your leadership style to the people that you are leading. And if we're trying to reach the lowest level, we have to be willing to have conversations that are uncomfortable, because to them, they're not uncomfortable. They're uncomfortable to us. Right. I don't think they're uncomfortable to them. Nope. And that's been my experience. Usually when we open the conversation, I'm the one kind of going, okay. And I will absolutely say, hey, look, I'm really old and I'm not really sure how to say this and I don't want to offend anyone, but here's what I don't understand. And so help me understand how I'm supposed to say that. One, that I should say it the right way. And then two, am I off the mark or what am I missing? Right? So they're interesting conversations. And I have tried to start back up now here, diversity and inclusion discussions. And I'm going to have one with my first set of crew folks over in the CSPOC here shortly. But I said, I wanted them to be small groups and I wanted them to get down and it's going to be me and them. And down to the tactical level with no filter, no commander, nobody involved. And it's for me to really get a sense of what are they struggling with? What do they need help with? Where do they sense that they are seeing barriers? I'm not going to tell you how many barrier analysis groups I've sat in and talked in, but even my data, when you ask me, what's it like to be a woman in the military, my experience was totally different than someone coming in now. Right. And so for me to make assumptions that what I went through is what they're dealing with now is absolutely wrong. And so I have to go back and reset data wise at the lowest level, if I'm really going to get after the concerns that they have. And so, it's being able to recognize that in this case, experience may not always be the best recipe, because you were raised and you had an experience that's very different than who is coming in today. And how do we talk to them and understand? I mean, if you have a teenager in your house, it's an interesting discussion. And you can see that they very much want the world to be different. They want to do different things. They have different ideas. They have way more information than we ever had. And so the conversations are very different than when I was a kid having these or growing up as a young lieutenant. So I just think we have to step out of our comfort zone and be willing to talk about it. And even say up front, I don't know how to say this and maybe not offend someone, but here's what I'm thinking. What do you guys think of that?
Right.
Be honest and let them say what they feel. We've had conversations. And why I say it's important to get down to the human level. I had a young female African-American captain who worked for me. She was my junior exec. And we had a great conversation and it was so funny. She goes, well, ma'am, your parents probably paid for you to go to college. And I went, no, actually I had a ROTC scholarship or I wouldn't have gone to college. And she's like, oh, well, I went to the academy and I wouldn't have gone to college had I not gone to the academy. I go, okay, great. But then our experiences diverge and that we have conversations about the cars you drive, how you dress, and how she is perceived, you know, like she gets pulled over because of the kind of car that she was driving. And it was an African-American cop who pulled her over and said, I wouldn't let my wife drive this car because people are going to assume some things about you and are going to pull you over every time. And it was like her dream car that she wanted her whole growing up, that she finally, after getting into the Air Force, had the money to buy. And I said, you know, that's really sad that you couldn't buy the car you wanted, and that there was some prejudice or bias that anyone who drives that kind of car must be a bad person or doing bad things. I go, that's sad. I didn't experience that. So absolutely, I can see the difference. But it took us having that conversation, and that both sides, we had perceptions about each other that were not true. And then there were definitely things that she experienced that I didn't experience, or I experienced differently. You're not going to know that if you don't get down and have those really down and dirty conversations. You're just not. You can't experience that. So Joe Raymond and Chief Toberman have gone out and done some town halls and small groups and been trying to do that. And I think we as senior leaders have to keep that dialogue going. And it's not just saying, hey, all my commanders, you should do it. You have to be doing those conversations as well as senior leaders.
Yes, ma'am. And as you start to talk diversity, inclusion, and then belonging and equality, again, I think some of the challenges, not necessarily just having the conversations, because people, I think, will tell you exactly what they feel, but it's how do you measure the change? How do you measure if it was effective enough? How do people not at the GO level learn to listen, learn to have those conversations? And I think that's part of the challenges with the belonging piece of diversity and inclusion, right, is that we have trouble doing that.
The other piece, I think, is truth to power, right? We're all talking a good game, but what are we doing? And so, you know, I absolutely, there's a lot of people who can tell you how they feel. I then try to flip the conversation of, okay, why don't you feel that you belong? And can you point to specific policies or processes or things that you've experienced that I can go fix, that I may not be seeing them that way, or I may not be experiencing them the same way? And it's amazing, again, when you get the right demographic of age group together, they quickly start, you know, providing that data. And as a senior leader, to just listen and go, okay, I can fix that thing. That's something I can go after. And then going after it and then publicizing you went after it. The follow through. That's, I think, what's got to happen versus just talking about it. And again, I think we're trying, but we have to put more energy as senior leaders at that, of addressing where the problems are, getting after them. These IG investigations that both chiefs have pushed forward and the secretary are great, about UCMJ action against people of color, the discussions about women in the military, how things are looked at. You know, I just saw the article the other day about pink tax on uniforms. All those things are critical to uncover and talk about. And then how do I go fix that? And there's absolutely ways to fix that, those things. And I think we're getting after it.
I think the last thing I'll tell you before I turn the last couple of minutes over to you, ma'am, is the generation that you mentioned they'll tell you exactly what they think and what they feel. What I've also found as I get a chance to go travel is, but they'll only say it once. And then once that trust is broken, then they're saying, you know what, I tried to talk, and we're done. So what you said was the tail or the sustainment is now what's next, and letting them understand that there are going to be some hard spots, but we are going to have small victories that are going to build on this. I know I can keep talking forever and catch up with you, but I imagine your team is looking at their watches right now. So, man, before we close out, first, thank you so much for what you're doing, for your leadership. Congratulations on the job, and I look forward to watching you. You know, one or two more promotions, maybe, right? That would be so awesome. But thank you very much for the time, man. I'll turn the last minute or two over to you for any closing remarks.
No, thanks, Big Dog. I really appreciate that you are doing this and paying it forward. Again, you're out of the military, but it's evident your passion here and getting after these conversations, because the more we can have these and we get more senior leaders on here with perspectives, we all have ways to look at this. And I think there's great opportunity here. You know, you talked about being vulnerable. This is an opportunity to be vulnerable and give people a voice to ask these things. I think the other piece, you know, I've tried to make myself available in many forums for question and answer, for people to ask me questions on these forums. So I hope, again, you get to some more interactive things with younger folks participating in these, but I think these are a great effort, and I appreciate your leadership in doing these. And I am always happy to come back again. I don't know about three or four, I don't know. My goal is to just work hard and do the right things every day. And where that takes me, it takes me. And again, I will continue to lead with my head and my heart. And, you know, that may trip me up someday. Being vocal and honest and putting some things out there could catch me someday. But if that's what I go down for, I'm okay with that, because I know I go down looking myself in the mirror, knowing I did the best I could do. And that's really all we can ask of any of our airmen and guardians is to do their best job and let the system take it where it goes.
Well, you said your father wanted you to make sure you could take care of yourself. So he was successful. Congratulations. And thank you for also taking care of everybody else.
Awesome. Thanks, Big Dog.